Hello, friends, and welcome to episode 1179 of the Juice Box Podcast. You didn't hear what just happened to me while I was trying to say hello, friends, but I'm going to cut it out, put it at the end so you can hear it later. Why am I here? Oh, I'm here to tell you that this is another cold wind episode. I'll be talking to a person today who we're going to call Jessica. Jessica has had type 1 diabetes since 1993 when they were diagnosed at 22 months old. That's right, she's 32 today. Jessica is a registered nurse. She's worked at an assisted care facility with an elderly population. Currently, she's in a criminal justice-based system that deals with people who have committed crimes or have significant psych issues. Please don't forget that nothing you hear on the Juice Box Podcast should be considered advice, medical or otherwise. Always consult a physician before making any changes to your healthcare plan or becoming bold with insulin. Hey, the T1D Exchange is looking for U.S. residents who have type 1 diabetes or are the caregivers of someone with type 1. They need you to take a survey. The survey takes about 10 minutes. Your answers to completely simple questions that you will know the answers to help to move diabetes research forward, specifically type 1 diabetes research. So if you want to help type 1 research, go take the survey, t1dexchange.org/juicebox. It's quick, it's easy, and you'll actually help. Today's episode of the Juice Box Podcast is sponsored by Touched by Type 1. This is a fantastic organization that I've been dealing with for years. I go to do their speaking events. They care about people with type 1 diabetes. They're doing terrific work for them, and I'd like for you to go check them out at touchedbytype1.org. Go find out what they're up to, and then follow them on Facebook and Instagram. Today's episode is sponsored by Medtronic Diabetes, a company that's bringing people together to redefine what it means to live with diabetes. Later in this episode, I'll be speaking with Jalen. He was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes at 14. He's 29 now. He's going to tell you a little bit about his story. And then later, at the end of this episode, you can hear my entire conversation with Jalen. To hear more stories with Medtronic champions, go to MedtronicDiabetes.com/juicebox or search the hashtag Medtronic Champion on your favorite social media platform. This episode of the Juice Box Podcast is sponsored by the Eversense CGM. Eversense is going to let you break away from some of the CGM norms you may be accustomed to. No more weekly or bi-weekly hassles of sensor changes. Never again will you be able to accidentally bump your sensor off. You won't have to carry around CGM supplies. And worrying about your adhesive lasting? Well, that's a thing of the past. EversenseCGM.com/juicebox. Let's find out a tiny bit about you first, Jessica. Do you have type 1 diabetes?
Yeah, since 1993.
93. How old were you then?
22 months.
Oh, no kidding.
Oh yeah, gosh. I was a little tater tot.
I was going to say, that's young. How about that? 93, 1003, 13, 23.
I'm 32 now.
Wow, look at that. Good for you. How you doing?
With my type 1, I'm okay. I have some early stage complications, but since going on a pump, those have kind of slowed down.
Mm-hmm. What were they?
Neuropathy and early stage renal disease.
Neuropathy in your feet, your hands?
Mm-hmm. Foot.
Foot. Your eyes
are perfect.
Okay.
Eyes are perfect. It's just my kidneys, and I was really stressed out, so my blood pressure was high.
Mm-hmm. And that doesn't help.
Some of my jobs. And so they put me on a blood pressure med, and guess what? Everything, the proteinuria cleared right up.
Oh, when they got your blood pressure under control. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's wonderful.
And my diabetes went better, like when I went on a pump.
How far into diabetes were you when that happened?
I was 25 years in.
Okay. Do you think, how would you categorize your care for the first 25 years, your outcomes?
I mean, I was on old school insulins with peaks and valleys called, it's not even made anymore. It was called Lente and Ultra Lente.
Mm-hmm.
And regular, like Lente and Ultra Lente aren't even made anymore.
Yeah. Did you have monitoring?
Yeah, we would check my sugar 4 times a day.
With a finger stick or some other way?
Yeah, finger stick.
Okay. Do you know what your A1Cs were when you were growing up?
Back then, they wanted you to ride higher. So they were between 7 and 8.
Okay. And you think they actually were, and that's where they wanted you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Because they didn't want lows to happen in kids, because there was some study somewhere mm-hmm. that said there was brain damage from Lowe's. I don't know what the new research shows,
yeah,
you know, because this was 30 years ago, but they didn't want all these lows. Like I would get low and have seizures.
Oh, of course.
Every time I dropped, I would get diabetic seizures like every time I hit 40.
And how often was that happening to you?
Oh God, I can't remember, but I do remember how much I hated the seizures because I would get tired after, but it wasn't like an epileptic seizure.
Okay.
You know, where you don't remember. I could remember how much it hurt to jerk around like a fish out of water.
I wonder how much that had to do with the existing insulin and how it worked. Because 40 is a little high to seize. You know what I mean? Although the monitoring probably wasn't terrific either. So who would even know? You know what I mean? Like exactly what your blood sugar was.
Right. And the meters were old. And sometimes we didn't check immediately. They just knew, oh God, she's seizing.
Gave you a bunch of stuff. Check your blood sugar. And now you're 40. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. I gotcha. All right. Well, that's interesting. And in any other episode, we would keep talking about that. But because this is a cold wind, we're going to fast forward significantly. And
you probably just like the background of to how people, how much damage they have based on the control from the back. You know what I mean?
Well, I want people who are talking to know who they're talking to and what kind of understanding of diabetes you have. Because we're going to be talking about it moving forward. And, you know, they should just know who you are a little bit. And I don't know about, like, you know, I just followed the course of your conversation. So if, you know, some people are fine, they don't have any complications, but I just want to know, you know, a little bit about when you were diagnosed, what you know, and what you've been through.
Yep.
Two different jobs of yours we're going to talk about today. Let's do them in chronological order. So the first one is, tell me about what your job was in the nursing home.
So I was a registered nurse. Meaning, you know, of course, the duties of a nurse, you would do assessments, admissions, administer medications, monitor for side effects of medications. Mm-hmm. Basic registered nurse duties that people are aware of that you would see in a regular hospital. It's just these are elderly, frail. Sometimes we'd get younger patients, sometimes with diabetes complications that could no longer take care of themselves because they were falling apart from bad care or sheer self-neglect. You know,
earlier in life than you would expect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. So there's kind of two different kinds of age groups you see. You see older that you expect to see in a nursing home, and you see slightly younger who have had enough medical issues that they've ended up there a little more quickly than the older people.
Mm-hmm.
Just let's first of all just talk about nursing home care to begin with. Let's say I bring my parent there. They live there now. I leave. They take a couple of medications a day. They've got some, I don't know, they've got some exercises they have to do. They live in a room basically by themselves, right? The room. What's the room?
I've been in one facility. I only worked there for a month, but my predominant facility was 3 years. Hmm. They'd have four roommates.
How large was the room?
Well, it was like you'd have a bed, probably 10 feet of room, and then another bed.
Wow. Four people.
And then across the hall, the same. Yeah. They fit four people.
Yeah. So east to west.
In between beds. Yeah.
And north to south.
And it was like you could hear everything. When you're doing care, there was only a curtain. You'd have up to four people or at least two. It depended on your insurance, though. Ah. If you had better insurance, you had a single room. You were on Medicare or Medicaid, you had all the roommates.
Gotcha. So more money gets you fewer roommates in this first place, but not privacy. Does it get you better care, more money?
Nope, because you still have nurses are still taking care of 26 or more patients.
Okay. So 26 plus patients on a floor. How many nurses to those 26?
One.
Oh.
I would have 26 patients I was responsible for.
How long was your shift?
8 hours, 3 to 11.
One nurse for 8 hours for 26 people.
Mm-hmm.
They all need something pretty consistently or no?
Yep. Everybody's completely debilitated with multiple comorbidities.
Okay. How do you even manage that? Like, do you just run from buzzer to buzzer or do you do what you need to do and try to get to people for the extra stuff when you can? This episode of the Juice Box Podcast is sponsored by the Eversense CGM. EversenseCGM.com/juicebox. The Eversense CGM is the only long-term CGM with 6 months of real-time glucose readings, giving you more convenience, confidence, and flexibility. And you didn't hear me wrong. I didn't say 14 days. I said 6 months. So if you're tired of changing your CGM sensor every week. You're tired of it falling off, or the adhesive not lasting as long as it should, or the sensor failing before the time is up. If you're tired of all that, you really owe it to yourself to try the Eversense CGM. EversenseCGM.com/juicebox. I'm here to tell you that if the hassle of changing your sensors multiple times a month is just more than you want to deal with, if you're tired of things falling off and not sticking or sticking too much or having to carry around a whole bunch of extra supplies in case something does fall off, then taking a few minutes to check out EversenseCGM.com/juicebox might be the right thing for you. When you use my link, you're supporting the production of the podcast and helping to keep it free and plentiful. EversenseCGM.com/juicebox. This episode is sponsored by Medtronic Diabetes. MedtronicDiabetes.com/juicebox. And now we're going to hear from Medtronic champion Jalen.
I was going straight into high school, so it was a summer heading into high school.
Was that particularly difficult?
Unimaginable. You know, I missed my entire summer. So I was going to a brand new school. I was around a bunch of new people that I had not been going to school with. So it was hard trying to balance that while also explaining to people what type 1 diabetes was. My hometown did not have an endocrinologist. So I was traveling over an hour to the nearest endocrinologist for children. So, you know, outside of that, I didn't have any type of support in my hometown.
Did you try to explain to people, or did you find it easier just to stay private?
I honestly just held back. I didn't really like talking about it. It felt like it was just a repeating record where I was saying things and people weren't understanding it. And I also was still in the process of learning it. So I just kept it to myself, didn't really talk about it.
Did you eventually find people in real life that you could confide in?
I never really got the experience until after getting to college. And then once I graduated college, it's all I see. You know, you can easily search Medtronic champions. You see people that pop up and you're like, wow, look at all this content. And I think that's something that motivates me. I started embracing more, you know, how I live with type 1 diabetes.
To hear Jalen's entire conversation, stay till the very end. MedtronicDiabetes.com/juicebox to hear more stories from the Medtronic champion community.
Do what you need to do and then get to the extra stuff. If like they're on the floor, of course, because they rang their buzzer and weren't tended to quick enough, I would have to stop what I was doing and tend to that. Somebody had chest pain. We had somebody with, or in the case of diabetes, a hypoglycemic episode. You'd be tending to those emergencies in between juggling the basic stuff like administering medications and assessments.
Is there any advanced doctoring going on? Like having a problem that isn't quite figured out yet, do people actually try to diagnose what's going on? Or is it just there's orders from their doctor about medications and we do that thing and that's it?
Well, if there is a change in condition, we would get them further care. We would call the doctor and say, hey, this person's exhibiting this. But typically it's just you get admission orders from the hospital because they would come from a hospital typically.
Okay.
You know, because the hospital would determine they needed further care along with the family. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they would be direct admits from family. It just depended on the situation. They would get their basic orders, like a basic, everybody got the same basic admission orders.
Yeah.
And then they would get their basic medications that they were prescribed by the doctor. And then they'd be seen once a month if they were on Medicare. Mm-hmm. I can't speak on the private pay, but Medicare patients can only be seen once a month. And then, which was kind of challenging for some patients because they were so sick and their conditions were rapidly changing, once a month wasn't enough.
Yeah.
So everything would be done by phone.
Okay. And that would be through the nurse and through the facility? Mm-hmm. Not because we're not asking the patients to speak for themselves at this point about their health, right?
Mm-mm.
No. Okay.
Nope. Everything's done by the nurse.
So then you're counting also on the nurse understanding what's happening and relaying it properly.
Yes.
Simple things like medication. I'm supposed to get something at noon. How likely is it I'm actually going to get it at noon?
We had an hour before or an hour after window to give medications. Mm-hmm. I would be given 9 o'clock meds at 10:30.
Okay. But that
11.
I gotcha. Because you're just rushing around. You're literally just, can you tell me if there's 26 rooms in a row, do you go get all the medication for 26? It sounds like you wouldn't. You'd probably go back and forth over and over again,
yes.
Right? Because you don't want to mix things up.
Right. You don't want to miss anything or have a med error. Now, I know some nurses would do the 26, but the thing is then if you have to hold a medication because their blood pressure or something was low, then you'd be picking through the cup trying to figure out what med it was.
Okay.
So I would just go back and forth and pop the pills out of the container.
Right.
Because they came in little med cards. So I would just do that as I would go, but you're going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth to the med cart, to the rooms.
What about a simple thing like a person who's wearing an adult diaper? They wet themselves. How long could they sit in that before it can get handled?
Sometimes I'd have one Cena for 40 patients, and nurses can help a Cena, but of course we had our nursing duties to tend to, right? Our medical care. Mm-hmm. But a Cena with 40 patients, they'd be waiting for hours.
Tell people what Cena means.
Certified nursing assistant.
Okay. Now, my mom is passed now, but she spent the last couple of years of her life in an assisted living facility. A certified nursing assistant, in my personal experience, was some poor kid with a part-time job or some lady who was working her second job or something like that, running around like crazy. And if you ask them any question, they didn't know the answer to anything. They were there performing tasks and that was it. Am I undervaluing that or is that about right?
That's about right because they don't have a lot of clinical knowledge. A lot of them, I had some really good ones that do basic things like keep the head of the bed up on a tube feeder. Mm-hmm. When you had those CNAs that had basic clinical knowledge, like some of them would say, you know, this dizziness isn't normal. I'm not going to get them out of bed because I'm going to go call the nurse. So some of them had more common sense than others.
Okay. So the good ones could do a little more thinking.
Yeah. And then they would be able to tell the nurse when something was going on.
Yeah.
We had some of them that knew the signs and symptoms of like low blood sugar in our brittle diabetics. They'd be like, you know what? You're acting funny. I gotta get the nurse.
I'm going to get the nurse. So tell me something. These people and you, difficult job being asked to run around like crazy for 26 people for 8 hours. These other poor people are changing diapers and bowel movements and cleaning people up afterwards. Crazy good paying job, right? You drive a Lamborghini, you were making like $1 million a year. Now, what does one of those Cenas make?
When I worked at the nursing home, about $13-$14 an hour.
Yeah, so for $13 an hour, I get to change people's diapers all day.
Right.
What a joy. Okay, and you're completely anonymous, Jessica. So what were you making?
I was making 30 originally, and then I went pool, as they call it. So I went up to 37 an hour.
30 to 37. And not just because, and you'd only been doing it for 3 years.
Yeah.
Did you consider that a reasonable compensation for what you were doing?
No.
No.
For the amount of tasks I had to do and liability I had on my license with that many patients, it was not reasonable.
Explain that part to people, liability on your license. What is that?
So what would happen is if you provided poor care, you could be, or something adverse happened based on the quality of the care you provided, they could file a complaint of your license as the state. Mm-hmm. The state would then investigate your license and you could actually lose your job.
Okay.
And your license, your livelihood, if there was an incident that something happened, which could be a lot of different things. So with 26 patients, I can't monitor all the minor changes. I can't prevent every wound from occurring because I can't turn everybody every hour. Mm-hmm. People are getting bed sores. That's a liability. People are falling. That's a liability. Because I've had, it wasn't my patient, but I know one woman whose patient fell and died.
Okay.
And she was in hot water because they're like, well, what did you do to prevent the fall?
That was on her. Right. And then there's a layer above you. Like there's the administration of the facility and then the owner, the ownership, which you don't know or see. The administration's under as much pressure as you are, right? Mm-hmm,
yeah. Because they want to pass the state inspection to get funding from CMS, the Center of Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Okay. Okay. Even at your 37, at your highest number, at your 37, how much cash in your hand at the end of the week did you have?
I was working part-time, so I was working about 12 hours a week. Mm-hmm. So 37 times 12, I'd have to do that math, which wasn't very much.
But at full time, you'd still be making 37, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay. Did you feel like the administration had your back as a nurse?
No, they were clueless. They walked around like no idea what was going on.
But they are people who previously had your job though, right?
The DON did, the director of nursing. Okay. The administrator is typically a business person. They have to be a licensed nursing home administrator, but their background is business and finance.
So it seems to me like your job is the difference between spinning plates and being told if they fall and break, we're going to sue you or you're going to get fired or something like that. And the plates being on a shelf and just, it's like, oh, it's your job to keep the plates there. Like, oh, I can keep those from falling. Meaning eventually the plates are going to fall. Like you can't avoid it forever, right? 26 older, frail people with a lot of comorbidities. You're running around like a lunatic. And does the place make money?
Yes.
Like, could they have hired two people for an 8-hour shift is what I'm getting at?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So this is a cost-cutting thing. Would you say a person in that situation, living in that situation, is it just like, I hate to say it like this, but is it storage? Like, is the idea like, listen, you don't have a lot of time left. We're just going to do our best here so you don't suffer and that you're getting what you need. But like, you're not looking for quality of life at that point, right?
In theory, you are always looking for quality of life because that's how the patients maintain their well-being. But the way the system is set up, you can't provide quality of care or quality of life.
Right.
I couldn't do range of motion like you're supposed to do. I couldn't sit everybody up, you know, like you're supposed to. I couldn't turn everybody like you're supposed to. The basic nursing stuff you learn in fundamentals of nursing, I couldn't do.
Because of time.
Because of time constraints, exactly. Like, in nursing school, they recommend people that can't sleep, try something like a warm lotion and back rub. Like, you know, nice tasks like that that the elderly appreciate.
Right.
Couldn't do it. Like, everything, just dope them up on pills to get them to fall asleep. Instead of trying non-pharmacological intervention, just dope them up on pain meds and put them to sleep that way.
Yeah. Yeah, I had to stop them from doing that to my mom at one point. I was like, hey, I think my mom is high all the time. What are we doing? And it wasn't what she was looking for either. I even thought like stuff that they would say like, oh, there's a community room she can go down to. We're not going to help her get there. Or, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, but if she can get there, great. And then if she walked out in the hallway and made one wrong turn, they'd be like, your mom doesn't seem to know where she is. I'm like, it's a big, like expansive corridors. Like she just got there. Like, I wouldn't imagine she'd know where she was. You know what I mean? And then they'd act like, well, so she can't go to the community room. It was like everything felt like an excuse to limit or not do something.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And when stuff didn't happen, it was kind of hilarious. So in my mom's room at the first place she was, there's, you know, a cord you pull for a bell, right? Goes to the nursing station. So my mom falls in the bathroom and she pulls the cord, but it doesn't work. It never alarms at the nursing station. Nothing happens. So luckily, my mom was trying to go to the bathroom and tidy herself up right before she knew somebody was going to come in. So she only spent about 10 minutes on the floor, but she was 10 minutes kind of folded on herself, not in, you know, in a precarious position. But luckily for her, someone was coming in, so she got found pretty quickly. And that made me, of course, call the place and say, look, you know, she pulled the bell didn't work. And she was, oh no, you know, we'll check into that. And then no one ever gets back to me. And then I press it and it's like, oh yeah, there is a problem with the bell system, but we're getting it fixed. And I was like, okay, great. But I called back in 2 weeks. Is the bell system fixed? No. I'm going to call you in 7 days. Is the bell system fixed? No. This went on and on and on until I really got upset and pressured it. We're going to get somebody out. We can't get somebody out here because of COVID. And I said, you can't get somebody out there to fix the bell system because of COVID? I was like, that doesn't make any sense. What does COVID have to do with any of this? And then they didn't have an answer for that. And then finally, one day, I was in my car, and Jessica, you know me if you listen to the podcast pretty well, but you don't know me. Scott in his 20s didn't have a good temper. So, but Scott as an adult is okay. But I get a call one day, I'm sitting in my car, I pull over to the side of the road, and a person gets on the phone and says, hey, we just wanted to let you know, when your mom fell, people didn't come, not because the bell didn't work in her room. The bell in her room works fine. And I went, okay. And I said, why didn't they come? And she said, the bell didn't work at the nurse's station. So the system works fine. It's just at the nurse's station, there was a problem. And I went, no, the system doesn't work fine. If one end of, it's a walkie-talkie. If one of them works and the other one doesn't work, the walkie-talkies don't work. She goes, no, your mom's walkie-talkie works. And we had this inane conversation that went on for a couple of minutes until, if I'm being honest, I screamed at her and hung up the phone. And I believe part of what I screamed was, fix it in 24 hours or I'm calling the state. And then 24 hours later, it was fixed. It was amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this is a little, I'll sidetrack a bit. I was a state, I did it for 8 months. I was a state licensing surveyor for nursing homes.
Mm-hmm.
With that, I was going through and making sure they were following the licensure guidelines. And something like a call bell not working could be a tag, like you said,
yeah,
because that puts the patients in danger. Anything that puts the patients in danger, it results in a fine.
Yeah. As crazy as that all was, by the way, and by the also in the time that that whole conversation was going on, like I told you, weeks into a couple months, they put literally bells like you would see on a desk. Like you remember in like old movies, you'd walk in and there wasn't somebody manning the desk and you'd ding, ding the bell. They put those in their rooms next to their bed. I'm like, well, how does that help her in the bathroom? Like, I don't, what are we doing? So they were literally dinging a bell to get people for a while. It was pretty horrible. Anyway, to me, the amount of times that the person I was on the phone with, the amount of times that she insisted that if one side of the walkie-talkie worked and the other side of the walkie-talkie worked, and you were holding the one that worked, the system worked, that told me everything I needed to know about that place for the rest of my life. She had something in her mind that she thought would keep me from being able to sue them. And she was not going to, she wouldn't say the system wouldn't work if both sides didn't work. She said, your mom's worked fine. She just kept saying that. And it was, I was like, okay, well, I'm obviously the truth isn't going to come out here. Let's talk about people with type 1 diabetes in that setting. What is being done for them? You're type 1. Is this how you'd want to be taken care of? Tell me the whole thing, really.
So what would happen is you would be on ACHS blood sugar checks, meaning before meals and at bedtime. So you'd get checked 4 times a day,
okay,
just like I did in the back in the day when I was first diagnosed. So they're doing it old school, right?
Yeah.
And then they would be on what's called for insulin, a sliding scale. I don't know if you know what that is.
I do.
Okay, so from when your daughter had it, I don't know if she was on a sliding scale.
She never has, but I've talked to 1,000 people who have done it. So, yeah.
So it works like, you know, 0 to 150, no insulin. Mm-hmm. 151 to 200, you get X amount of units. 200 to 250, so many units, and so on and so forth. And the scale typically stops at 400. And then at 400, you give 11 units, just a example number. And then you call the doctor immediately.
Okay.
So it's like you're not getting meal coverage. You're just getting so many units.
So could I, before a meal, be under a certain level and they wouldn't even give insulin for the food?
Correct.
So if my blood sugar is 149, you won't give me insulin?
Typically, no.
Okay.
In most sliding scales.
But I'm about to eat. So you come back to me before the next meal, where I'm assuming you find my blood sugar in the 300s, and then I get insulin for that.
Yes.
Oh.
So it's kind of like you're good at breakfast because you get your Lantus, you know, at night, mm-hmm, which typically it was a lot of, our facility used a lot of Lantus.
Okay.
That was what was on formulary, you know, and this was,
yeah,
it's just, it goes off the formulary, right? So you'd get your Lantus typically at bedtime. And then you'd usually get enough Lantus to where your blood sugar was great at night.
Mm-hmm.
So you were almost like feeding the basal, you know, because you'd wake up great overnight. And then they would expect that sliding scale to cover you for breakfast, or the Lantus to cover you for breakfast, which we all know basal rates isn't supposed to cover a meal.
Yeah.
You would only get meal coverage after like a month or more of bad blood sugars. Then they might give you 2 units for a meal, like a very small amount for meal coverage, but that was only when the sliding scale failed.
So were most of those people living with higher blood sugars?
Correct.
Yeah. And that affects their ability to be happy, I would imagine. And if they're in the middle of healing, that also slows that down.
It's not conducive to their well-being.
Right, right. But it's not a consideration. Nobody says, Mary has a wound on her arm, let's try to keep her blood sugar tighter so it heals more quickly, or something. That we don't talk about it like that.
No, we just do wound care, like the wound care that the wound care doc orders, but the diabetes perspective is never considered in that.
Yeah. So these people are basically being treated like an old car that's falling apart that we can't afford to replace. So we'll just fix whatever falls onto the ground and then hope the bumper stays stuck. And if it doesn't, we'll glue it back on until the door handle falls off. But we're not trying to renovate the car, I guess is what I'm saying.
they're not, I don't know what the A1C goal is of the ADA now. Like I said, back in my day, it was below 7. I think it's still below 7. We weren't shooting for that. It was just like you said, just repair them. Their A1C came back at 8. We might modify the insulin depending on the patient.
Right.
But they weren't shooting for an A1C of 5.5.
Yeah. Do you know if I asked you what the average amount of time is a person stays alive after they enter a facility?
We had patients that were there for 10 years.
Wow.
But those ones were generally had less conditions. Mm-hmm. They might have just had like severe debility, like muscle weakness and wasting. And they were private pay. So the private pay ones lived a little longer because most of them were less sick.
Okay. So private pay people, that would indicate I can't live at home by myself anymore. I don't have family to live with. And I've got some cash so I can afford to move into another place. So they show up a little sooner, but they're not as sick when they get there.
Yes.
Okay. The sicker you are when you get there, the less time you have.
Correct.
Okay. How would you feel if your diabetes was managed the way theirs is?
Horrible. That's the sliding scale is what we did back in the day when I was first diagnosed. And my dad recently looked at my logs and he goes, "Nat, I'm surprised you're not dead today." And he's that type A, like personality, like perfection.
Yeah.
But we didn't have half unit syringes. And I was, 22 months. So you're guessing game based on one unit and eyeballing a half a unit on a syringe. So he, like I said, he looked at those numbers and said, "How the hell do you not have
much bigger problems?"
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he tried his absolute hardest, like to have a normal childhood, yet have good numbers. Mm-hmm.
Jessica, if I Google how long does the average person live in a, in the next word that populates, self-populates in Google is America, but the second one is a nursing home.
That's funny.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty average question I'd ask. The current average length of stay in a long-term care facility is 2.5 years.
Yeah, that sounds about right. If you look at admission dates on the computer and then a death date.
Yeah, that's on NJ. That's from NJ.gov, probably because I'm in New Jersey, so Google fed me back something local. It was tough because you had that thought when my mom went in. Like, I felt like, it felt like you were on a countdown. Like, she can live 2.5 years. Honestly, it worked out almost exactly like that. So then the question is society doing something wrong? And are they doing it just because of money? Like, so if all those people, no matter how beat up they were, if they all had their own nursing care and could see a doctor more than once a month, do you think they'd last longer than they do?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Is that a reasonable thing to ask? Now, you're a person who's got type 1, you worked in that setting, even if all the money was available and the facility was willing to spend it and put all the nurses in there, like how much would that change their lives, do you think?
Significantly.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, because no one feels good at 300. We'd have patients riding in the 300s all day. But then it's like I would do that previously in life because we didn't have CGMs in my mid-20s. I was on Medicaid.
Yeah.
So I didn't have a CGM. So I purposely ride high because I couldn't feel my lows and I'd pass out at work.
Right.
I'd passed out at the nursing home twice.
Okay.
And that was scary. They almost dialed 911 for one of them, because you can't have the nurse go down. So
I laughed because there's not one more nurse there to help you. That's the part that made me laugh.
So luckily I had one nurse that was able to help. It was the dementia ward, which was like harder because the people would refuse care. Mm-hmm. I'd get hit all the time, but they took me off the dementia ward upon my request because it was just too crazy.
Yeah.
But yeah, I passed out and my coworker slapped me across the face to get me responsive to pain, literally like slapped me frontwards and backwards. Mm. And then she forced juice down my throat. Like I could suck with a straw just enough to get the juice down my throat.
To get out of it. Wow. Oh, that's scary.
Yeah. Well,
so you would keep your blood sugar higher. And but now that monitoring exists. You wear a CGM now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I love it.
You don't keep your blood sugar at 300 anymore.
No.
No. Okay. Is there any way in that setting that you could manage someone who couldn't help themselves the way you're managing now?
No, not with the number of patients I had. The average 26 divided by 8. I'd have to do a calculator how many minutes you had to care for them. But it was less, it was like 15 minutes, if that.
Okay.
If I'm only seeing you 15 minutes a shift, I can't manage you as tightly as I could.
Yeah.
And then we're not trained in pump therapy. Most people don't come in on pump therapy. And depending on the state, Medicaid or Medicare might not cover pump therapy.
Yeah.
So the facilities take away anything that would provide tight control because they don't want the liability of somebody accidentally overdosing on insulin with a pump. So
did you ever see an older adult who just really understood their diabetes and like, listen, I can do this? Or did they lose their ability to take care of themselves once they get there legally?
We had a lot of people that were alert and oriented times four, person, place, time, situation.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew that they weren't being managed and they're demanding to call the doctor,
right?
You know, because they knew what was up. They knew it wasn't healthy to be 300 and have the nurse laissez-faire use a sliding scale.
Yeah.
Because they would just be on the yo-yo.
Right, right, right.
You're giving them no units for 0 to 49. Then they're up to 400. Then you're slamming them with 11 units.
Mm-hmm.
And then they skip their meal because they're not hungry because they feel so crappy, right? No one likes being 400. And then you're slamming 11 units in them, which I know everybody's insulin needs vary, but then they bottom out.
Yeah.
So they just get on this yo-yo and I can't provide the care that I know that they need.
Right. Yeah, it's never going to happen.
Mm-mm.
There's no fix to it, right?
Correct.
Yeah. This is a slightly off topic question, but I want people to have some context. Did you ever experience a family bring an older person in, get them settled, say, hey, we'll see you Monday, and literally never come back?
All the time.
Were they literally abandoned?
Yes.
Yeah. So I learned how common that was from a friend of mine, and it really did shock me. So they get their parent to the facility, get them checked in, and then just ghost them. Like, don't pay the bills. Don't ever talk to them again. They just disappear.
Yes.
Yeah. That's not uncommon. Yeah. Okay. Well, we're all doomed. That's fine. At least you picked a good name, Jessica. That's nice. We can be happy about that for a couple of minutes. Can I ask you, the first time you realized that happened, what did you think? Do you remember the first time you realized this person's been abandoned here?
It breaks your heart because we become your family, you know, and I can't provide you that same emotional support that I could if I had less patience.
Mm-hmm.
And those patients need a little more love. We would be hugging patients, you know, with ones that were allowing us to.
Yeah.
I'd have patients crying and you'd be holding their hand, but you're holding their hand for 2 minutes, not until they're done crying.
Right. You're like, okay, I got to go. I have to say that the people that my mom intersected with personally in her room were always terrific. Always. And nobody was unkind. I always felt like you're describing, like there's not enough time for me to do the thing that needs to be done here. And if you want something to happen, you have to do it yourself. Like I would have to call doctors and browbeat them into just doing their jobs. Like just really just push and push and push. I had a general practitioner who was mismanaging my mom's blood pressure, for example. And I finally just said to him, like, why won't you send her to a cardiologist? Like, you're using a really old medication. It doesn't seem like you know what's going on here. Like, why don't we give her to somebody that could help her? And then he did that. And then they were able to bring her blood pressure down. But for the months that he messed around with it, she couldn't get her cancer infusions to help keep her cancer away. And then my mom dies eventually because her cancer comes back. But my mom's cancer comes back possibly because this guy messed around getting her blood pressure down, and so she couldn't get these infusions that were meant to help keep the cancer away after it had been removed. It feels hopeless while they're there. Everything about it felt hopeless, and the only thing that kept my mom from feeling hopeless was her trying to keep up her good attitude. And that's the other thing, is she's trying to keep up that good attitude while basically most of her life is puzzle books and television and music and not much else, in a tiny room and nowhere to go. And nobody to help her go somewhere if she wanted to. So here's a hard question. And then we're going to move to your next job. If you got to the age where this was going to happen to you, you were going to have to go into an assisted living facility, but you had a switch, you could just turn your lights off and be done. Would you turn yourself off or go into the facility?
Turn myself off.
You would. Because
I don't want to die of a bed sore. Mm-hmm. I don't want to die of diabetes complications where you suffer, you know, like with the going to dialysis, being poked and prodded at there. Like I said, bed sores are very common in nursing homes because people are not being turned every hour like they're supposed to be.
Yeah.
I don't want to die of drowning in my own fluid from heart failure because they couldn't get my blood pressure under control. I mean, just the variety of problems that occur, I would just, like you said, I would just keep the switch off and call it a night.
And even personal, like affirming personal interactions with family, they're too few and far between to be meaningful, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, families, like we had one lady where her son was only concerned if she was eating. That's it. Because when people stop eating, that's when you're ready to go.
Yeah.
So he would call me every week at the same time. And it was my shift. It was, I don't remember if it was a Monday or a Tuesday, but he would call and I would just tell him, it was a 5-minute conversation. Your mom is eating. I'd pull up the screen about 25 to 50% per meal. And he'd go, is she taking her supplement? Because we'd have Ensure shakes. You probably know what Ensure shakes are.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we've all seen them on the TV. Is she taking her Ensure at least? Yes. And eventually she was eating 10% of a meal. You know, it got less and less, and then she passed. But the son appreciated just a nurse, like, calling him and telling him, this is how your mom is doing.
So he could understand what was happening. It's horrible for everybody too, by the way. I'll tell you, like, I'd go visit my mom a lot and, bye mom, I'll be back. I'll see you on Friday. Like, but you go out the room and you close the door and you just stand there for a second and you're just like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm leaving. I can't believe I'm leaving her here. I feel terrible. She must be doing the same thing on the other side of that door that I'm doing right now. She must be sitting there thinking, oh my God, I can't believe he left. I can't believe he's not going to be back till Friday. Like, you know, it's just, it's tough. Listen, I'm sure there are plenty of people who have quality of life at the end of their life, but for the ones that don't, it isn't great. So, okay. So they're not getting good care for their diabetes. It's just, like I said, you're gluing the mirror back on when it falls off, but we're never going to pull the car over for an hour, pull all the mirrors and bumpers and doors off, strip it down, paint it and start over again. It's just, let's see if we can keep this thing together for as long as we can drive it down the road. Your next job, where did you work at the next place? And is that where you are now?
Yes.
Okay.
It is a forensic psych facility, which is state operated and run. Mm-hmm. For patients that have committed a crime and they go there instead of jail because they were, I don't like the term crazy, but they were crazy and were mentally ill at the time of their crime.
Okay.
I won't say the legal status because that could identify the state, but it's a particular legal status.
Okay. All right. So people end up there because either they were mentally ill and committed a crime or mentally ill temporarily while they committed a crime or said that they were once they got to court and the court believed them. That's pretty much how you end up there. Okay. People who have killed people?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
So from murder to...
something like maybe attempted murder, vehicular manslaughter.
Okay.
We had one guy that had bipolar disorder and was driving a car recklessly and harmed a person.
I see. All right. So you're running the gamut there with that situation. Now, are these people, they're there for their... for the mental health side of it, they don't necessarily have physical problems, right?
Correct. But we do get people with physical problems, right? Mm-hmm. Because like right now we're taking care of it. We have a type 1 on my unit.
Okay. So let's talk about that specific situation. Type 1 diabetes on that unit. Well, I guess, first of all, how many people are you taking care of in a shift? How long's a shift?
12 hours. You have two nurses for a house of 20.
Well, that's better. Are you getting paid any better, any worse?
Slightly better, but I have more experience now. Okay. I'm making about 40 an hour now.
Making 40 for having more experience. You don't get a VIG for them having murdered somebody and you still have to help them? That doesn't work that way, huh? Okay. Are you ever frightened for your own safety?
Sometimes.
Yeah, because?
Because these patients have committed a violent crime. They murdered somebody one time. They lost their marbles, murdered somebody one time. What if they go, what if their mental illness starts cycling again? Are they going to become violent? Mm-hmm.
And you are in a room with them. They're not restrained or anything like that, right? They're just they're living.
Yesterday, I had three guys almost beat each other up. I had to get I had to pull off and say, you go sit down in your chair. You put your shirt back on and sit down. I was firm. I mean, maybe not the most therapeutic, but these two guys needed somebody blunt and short.
Right.
So I was like, put your shirt on and sit down. And he did.
First of all, why is your shirt not on? And secondly, stop hitting you. What, do you know what they were fighting about?
Some girlfriend thing. There was a bunch of girlfriend drama and they were playing a card game and the other guy was mocking him because he lost. So one guy was mad because he stole his girlfriend, and then the other guy was mad at the same guy because he was mocking him over a card game.
These guys have girlfriends?
Yeah. Like, we have 6 units.
Oh, they're girls. They're other women in the facility. They're not people coming to visit them that are their girlfriends.
Sometimes they are.
Really? Okay. And how many people in a room in that situation?
Usually, like, if we'll have visitation that's pre-scheduled, you have a staff supervising, of course, because they're not allowed to, like, be too personal, like a peck on the cheek, maybe one peck on the lips, and then that's a wrap.
Okay.
You're not allowed to sit there and get touchy-feely with each other.
Right.
But on other units, we have 6 units total. I work on the intake unit, the initial admission unit, so it's a little wilder.
Because they haven't settled into their lives yet.
Correct.
And once they settle in, how many people live in a room? Are they singles or are there multiple people in those rooms?
On the intake room, it's singles on the intake unit because patients are too unstable. Mm-hmm. And then on the regular units, it's about two people per room.
2 people per room. Okay. Okay. Varying age ranges, very young, very old.
We've got 18 all the way up to their 60s, sometimes 70s.
And if that 18-year-old murdered somebody and had a life sentence, they'll live there the rest of their life?
It's a privilege system. I won't go into that, but they could be released early, kind of like probation, but they're still under the jurisdiction of the court. You know, they have to follow the rules of their release. Mm-hmm. If they don't, they come right back to the hospital.
Place is always full, never an open bed.
Right now, we got a few open beds, but we're filling up again.
Okay.
We've got to get people moved along to the release unit, but that's all up to the courts.
Does this cycle throughout the year? I don't know how this is going to sound, but you know, I run a pretty big Facebook community, and there are certain times a year that people are a little less stable than other times of year. Like Thanksgiving to New Year's is one of those spots, for example. Like, do you see that ebbs and flows?
Yeah, because the holidays are hard on people because, like, they can get visits for the patients that do have families in the area. Mm-hmm. But we had a couple people, one guy was just passing through.
And he committed a crime, and now he's there.
Yeah, and he's got a 10.5-year sentence, and he served about 6 of them. Mm-hmm. But the holidays, he's just calling his family. He's not there enjoying the cranberries and the stuffing and, you know.
Is there a moment when somebody's been there long enough that you see them as the person they used to be? Like, do they get to a point sometimes where you're like, oh my gosh, like, you don't even belong here anymore? Like, how does that work?
Well, hopefully they get their meds right. Not everybody is severely mentally ill. Some of them just had a psychotic break. Like, we have a postpartum depression case that really breaks my heart. Mm-hmm. Because she was postpartum and couldn't get the help that she needed, you know, that so she was temporarily insane. She wasn't fully, but we keep her on her meds to keep away any signs of depression, but she's not on heavy duty meds,
right?
Like antipsychotics. Then we've got other patients where we hope to get their antipsychotics up where they're good. Uh-huh. And they're completely normal.
Yeah.
Like, they can talk coherently. They know what's going on. They're not hallucinating anymore.
So they almost feel like they're experiencing that place the way you are.
Yeah. And
yeah.
I also live with a serious mental illness, and they're like me, mm-hmm. like functional. And you're like, wow, you could go get a job if you wanted.
You're having not made that mistake away from being me. And do you ever feel like, and I'm having made your mistake away from being you? You ever think about that? Not that we're here to dig through you a little bit.
Yeah, I'm like, you always wonder, like, wow, how did I get so lucky to have the treatment team that I did that didn't let me down?
Right. Because that's how you see what's happened to them sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So if one of those people has type 1 diabetes, how are you managing for them?
Oh, we'll call him Paul. We got 2 patients I've managed. One of them's now on a different unit, but we'll call the one guy Paul. Paul was managed with a sliding scale, like in my long-term care facility.
Right.
His numbers were so up and down. He was like, we weren't sure if he was a brittle diabetic, as they used to call it.
Yeah.
Or if we were just mismanaging it. I thought the facility was mismanaging it because I know how to treat type 1.
Right, right.
I know how to use Lantus and carb counting and correction factors. Again, just a sliding scale.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you couldn't eat snacks, but he would eat snacks because what would happen if you eat carbohydrates uncovered? Yeah. You go up.
Right.
So we weren't covering it. And the guy was hungry, like in between meals, and he wasn't like overweight. He was very active, actually. And poor Paul would just skyrocket. But it was like, sorry, dude, I can't give you insulin with, you know, and I would feel bad because I know I just bolus whenever I want to eat. Right.
Yeah.
But we don't have that option. It's just before, check the blood sugar before meals, bedtime, and as needed.
Mm-hmm.
Like if they're showing signs or symptoms of hypoglycemia.
I gotcha.
So I just, Paul, though, I have nightmares of him.
Why?
His sugars were so badly managed. Okay. He'd go to 40 to 400 in one day.
Mm. And it doesn't matter because we're not actually proactively doing anything. We're just doing something on a schedule of when the meal comes up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. I mean, I can't imagine that this is much different. There's no answer to this question either. We can't let Paul have his own medication, right? He can't be in charge. Even if he was younger and not sick, you wouldn't put insulin in his care, I imagine.
No, and yeah. It was sad because we wanted him. He was also illiterate.
Okay.
English was not his first language.
Mm-hmm.
So poor Paul was different language speaking without revealing what state I work for. And it was like the one doctor wanted to put him on a pump. We don't have a patient with a pump, but we had another patient sue the facility to get on a Libre.
Right.
Because he said, I want to be on the best control possible. So he successfully sued the state to be on a Libre because they're very, you know, they're more expensive than checking the sugar four times a day.
Yeah.
But he had to sue the state to get that right.
Is that a thing he actually did or did his family step in and do it for him?
He had his lawyer do it, him and his lawyer, because he knew that this tech was out there because his family told him about it. And they watch TV.
Right. So they could see it.
So they see and they watch cable where all the ads are.
I saw a Libre ad last night during the Oscars. So
they're watching it and they see this tech and then they're like, well, why can't I have that? And they're like, oh, well, we're not going to pay for it. So he sued.
And he got it.
It was otherwise he'd have to pay him out.
But now that you see the blood sugar constantly, are you doing anything about it?
They referred him to endocrinology.
Is he getting better care now? Is a CGM the answer?
I would say it's a big proponent because you can see that, I mean, we would never do something as advanced as carb counting just because a lot of my nurses are not trained in it.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know how to carb count. Half of them are bad at math. The computer system doesn't permit that.
Okay.
Like the medical record, the one we use does not permit that carb counting with the correction factor and all that. It was horrible because, I mean, his numbers, we saw how bad they were.
Jessica, did you just say half the nurses are bad at math?
Yes.
Like, I mean, counting?
Like doing division. Like I have 32 carbs and it's a ratio of 1 to 8. Like the kid we got now, he's 18, diagnosed at 9.
Right.
This is a different patient. So Paul was our bad non-English speaking diabetic.
Right.
We have a new one. We'll call him Jonathan.
Okay.
So Jonathan knows how to carb count. And apparently when he was in juvenile hall, they would do carb counting. I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. But his ratio, he goes, my ratio is 1 to 8, which I laughed about because I'm in a 1 to 8 ratio.
You're like twinsies.
So I was like, okay. So I go, because he's like, if I eat 32 carbs, I'd get 4 units. I go, so your ratio is 1 to 8. He goes, yeah, what? I think so. But he knew we ought to do the math. That much head. Enough.
Yeah, yeah.
So he knew it. And he's like, why aren't we doing this for me? And I said, well, the doctor wants to see a pattern of your numbers. He goes, you guys are just giving me numbers based on my number. You're not doing anything to manage the carbs.
Right.
Why am I not getting insulin with my meals, even if I'm 140?
Yeah.
Same thing you asked earlier.
Right.
This kid knows how to manage his numbers because he committed his crime in his early teens and he's sentenced to life. But he knew how to manage his sugars, which was really hard because he knows what's up.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting here, I know what's up. And he's just, we're not giving him the care that he deserves or the care he was receiving before. Yeah. He's 300. I was like, I looked at my coworker yesterday as we give this kid 11 units because he was 318. He goes, you know, I'm like, this kid's going to be blind by 30.
So you know what's happening. Does the administration understand it?
I have nothing against nurse practitioners, but they're not endocrinology specialists. They're not an endocrinology NP. They're right. A generalized nurse practitioner.
Yeah.
So they start simple and then they might refer them to endo if they can admit that they're not doing a good job.
Mm-hmm.
but it takes a little bit of their ego away.
Jessica, for people who might listen to this and say, oh, yeah, sure, these people don't know, but look at the places they're working. This is where we house people that we've given up on or who have, you know, committed crimes. But you could go be a nurse in a regular hospital, no trouble, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You're credentialed. You understand. You could handle it.
Yeah. Yeah. I've worked in a hospital before.
Right. Okay. I don't think that, by the way. I just imagine it's possible that some people could be listening and thinking that you're the nursing equivalent of the lady that makes the fries. You know what I mean? Like, but that's not the case. Like, you're an RN just like everybody else.
I'm an RN just like everybody else. Now, right. Psych gets a bad rap because we're not the heroes, but we treat the patients that nobody wants. Society's throwaways, because mental illness still has a strong stigma attached to it.
Of course.
My patients have committed heinous crimes, but I still treat them with the same level of respect that I would somebody that hasn't committed a crime. Yeah. They get the same amount of loving care that my long-term patients did, or that I wanted to give to my long-term care patients. Mm-hmm. I get upset when they're sad. I get upset when their blood sugars aren't being managed. You know, I feel like, not bad for them in pity, but I have empathy for my patients despite them doing horrible things.
Yeah. When you offer them compassion, do you see them change?
Sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, like the one guy that got into a fight yesterday, he has to go outside for a walk. So I took him outside, you know, to help him cool down. And he appreciated that. We just talked for a little bit. I told him, hey, what you did was not appropriate. He reflected on it.
Right.
And he cooled off.
That's nice.
And he appreciated that.
It makes me wonder, and it's not what we're talking about, but it makes me wonder if, like, maybe if somebody would have done that for him when he was younger or something, if maybe, like, his situation wouldn't have changed. I know some people's mental illness is unstoppable, but I wonder how many times people are kind of pushed into situations as well. Anyway, well, I'm going to say again what I've been saying at the end of these cold wind episodes for a long time. I don't know why I thought this was a good idea, but I can tell you they're actually really popular. So people enjoy listening to these conversations. I think it's because, I mean, for me, like, again, you didn't say anything here today that shocked me, but it's still eye-opening for someone to say it out loud. You know, you're going to send your mom to this place, and let's be honest, this is the end. You know what I mean? Like, if you think they're there living like a pony running in a field, that's probably not happening. If they have health concerns on top of that, they're going to be managed as well as possible, but you know, possibly by one nurse every 8 hours for 26 different people, which sounds like you must have gotten there, taken a deep breath, started working, and before you knew it, it was 8 hours was over.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. I can't imagine there was even like a half a second in there anywhere.
No, you didn't. Like I said, I would have to ride at 200 because otherwise I'd pass out. I was clocking 24,000 steps a day.
Let's just say, because you're running around like crazy. Yeah. How about that? Is there anything I haven't talked about or asked you about that I should have? Something that...
No, it's just, like I said, in the psych facility, the blood sugars are managed just as bad as long-term care. Mm-hmm. And it breaks my heart because I got, like I said, the 18-year-old. I don't want him blind. Yes, he did something horrible, but he's actually, like, nice, and I would never wish diabetes complications upon anyone.
Yeah. Well, listen, if we're going to house people, it's got to be compassionately at the very least. I mean, I know you can't do something if one of my nurses just judges me for what I've done and they don't want to help me anymore, but they will, but they're just, I'm going to get bare bones from them because they're not as compassionate maybe as you are. But you also have, it's interesting, isn't it? You have a personal reason to be able to maybe understand their situation a little better. I mean, you can share your thing if you want, but I'm not asking you to, but like you have a bit of a connection. Is that right?
I would say so.
Yeah.
Because I live with it. I am actually, I'll joke, more medicated than some of my other patients to keep my condition stable. And I function very well. Nobody knows. I told like two coworkers and they're like, I would have never guessed. Mm. So I managed to pull off the stable appearance.
Are you stable? You're just appearing stable.
at least it works. You know, it's
questionable
knows.
One day. You don't think one day that you'll like somebody's going to look over from the other bed and go, didn't you used to be my nurse? Nothing.
When I wasn't taking, because I go up and down with taking my meds because they're a pain to take. And I also have to face living with a really bad disorder. It's a story. I'm more like apt to take care of my diabetes than the mental illness.
Yeah. Well, this has been something. I really do appreciate you coming on and sharing this with me. It's a unique perspective. And it's also kind of nice to hear that no matter what we did for my mom, I don't know if this makes it better or not, but at least I know I wasn't missing something, that this is the situation. What I saw happening is really what happens, that she wasn't being treated any more poorly than anybody else was when she was being treated poorly. I might opt for the switch too, so you know, Jessica. All right. Thank you very much. Hold on for 1 second for me. I want to talk to you at the end here. Bio. Private,
okay.
Okay. Jalen is an incredible example of what so many experience living with diabetes. You show up for yourself and others every day, never letting diabetes define you. And that is what the Medtronic Champion community is all about. Each of us is strong, and together, we're even stronger. To hear more stories from the Medtronic Champion community, or to share your own story, visit MedtronicDiabetes.com/juicebox and look out online for the hashtag Medtronic Champion. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoy my full conversation with Jalen, coming up in just a moment. A huge thanks to a longtime sponsor, Touched by Type 1. Please check them out on Facebook, Instagram, and at touchedbytype1.org. If you're looking to support an organization that's supporting people with type 1 diabetes, check out Touched by Type 1. A huge thank you to Eversense CGM for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. Are you tired of having to change your sensor every 7 to 14 days? With the Eversense CGM, you just replace it once every 6 months via a simple in-office visit. Learn more and get started today at eversensecgm.com/juicebox. If you're ready to level up your diabetes care, the Diabetes Pro Tip Series from the Juice Box Podcast focuses on simple strategies for living well with type 1. The Pro Tip episodes contain easy-to-understand concepts that will increase your knowledge of how insulin works, and so much more. My daughter has had an A1C between 5.2 and 6.4 since 2014 with zero diet restrictions, and some of those years include her in college. This information works for children, adults, and for the newly diagnosed, and for those who have been struggling for years. Go to juiceboxpodcast.com and click on Diabetes Pro Tip in the menu, or head over to episode 1000 of the Juice Box Podcast to get started today with the episode Newly Diagnosed, We're Starting Over. And then continue right on to episode 1025. That's the entire Pro Tip series, episode 1000 to 1026. If you're looking for community around type 1 diabetes, check out the Juice Box Podcast private Facebook group, Juice Box Podcast, Type 1 Diabetes. But everybody is welcome. Type 1, type 2, gestational, loved ones, it doesn't matter to me. If you're impacted by diabetes and you're looking for support, comfort, or community, check out Juicebox Podcast, Type 1 Diabetes on Facebook. Thank you so much for listening. I'll be back soon with another episode of the Juicebox Podcast. And now me trying to say hello, friends. Hello, friends. Hello, friends. Hello. Hello, friends. And welcome to episode 1179 of the Juice Box Podcast. The episode you just heard was professionally edited by Wrong Way Recording, wrongwayrecording.com.